Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. Martha Moxley was a beautiful 15-year-old who had the rest of her life before her. However, just before Halloween in 1975, this young girl was savagely murdered. What's more devastating is that justice has yet to be served. This is True Crimecast.
This is True Crimecast. Jamie and John back for our second episode of 2021.
We have a big announcement to make. If you didn't notice, you're going to see something weird on our channel, right, Jamie?
Yeah, we have a lot of cases that we've just not been able to work into a full episode or fit into the schedule. So we're introducing True Crime to Go, which is a brief look into crimes we find interesting, but can't work into our regular rotation.
So basically what that means is you're going to get even more of True Crimecast. It's not going to be available every week right now. We're going to test the waters, see how it goes. And if you all enjoy it and download it, then we'll keep it coming. Jamie pitched this idea a long time ago, and we thought 2021 would be a heck of a year to bring this about. So let's do it.
Yeah, super excited. That's a great reason to subscribe, so you automatically download those. We're going to keep them around 10 minutes. If you have a short commute, if you have 10 minutes between Zoom calls for your job, it's going to be an express way to get true crime.
Yeah, so there's one already available, so go over there, check it out. It released Monday?
Sounds about right.
Yeah,
we'll
so
see.
It's there now. Go check it out. All right, we got a few people we want to thank. Jamie, I'm going to let you do that.
Yeah, big thanks to our new Patreon supporters, Pat, Lachlan, Jamie, which is not me, Mabel. We appreciate all of you guys supporting us, coming in at the $3 level, which means, what do they get, John?
Yeah, $3 is going to get you a bonus episode each and every month. There's tons of content over there right now on Patreon.com. Just go to Patreon.com. While you're there, search for True Crimecast. And then there's several episodes you can get your hands on instantly. So for as little as a cup of coffee at Starbucks, you can get a lot of bonus content from True Crimecast. But hey, if you don't want to do that, just keep downloading, subscribe, and you're going to get more anyway.
Yep. We're going to keep bringing it your way. And like on last week's episode, John kind of confessed that he's quick to say that every case is the craziest case we've ever covered.
I'm not going to say that this week.
I'm not either, but it has some awesome twists and turns as far as just unexpected things happening in the course of the investigation and proceedings. So that's why I'm excited about this one.
I've got to be honest. I mean, you know, it's awful and it's tragic that someone dies, but these types of cases are my favorite to get my hands on because serial killers, I feel like everybody does those. We're going to be talking about a 15-year-old that was tragically murdered, and the case is just kind of, it went cold and then it picked back up for like years after the fact. So it is a roller coaster ride and it's a good one. So,
there's some recent developments as well that we're excited to share about that. That happened just at the end of last year. So go ahead and get us rolling, John.
Yeah, man, we're going to be talking about Martha Moxley. So in 1975, she was 15 years old. She was seemingly on the top of the world. She was pretty. She was popular. She came from a great family. She had her entire life ahead of her. Just before Halloween, however, everything changed. Martha vanished after spending time at a home of a family friend. So the family's sons, who were also teenagers and coincidentally close relatives of the Kennedy family. So I'm talking about the Kennedys, like John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And those teenage boys quickly became the prime suspects and were even arrested in connection with her disappearance and death. It would take decades for them to be pursued as suspects. And when they did, it turned into an endless legal fiasco. Another suspect would emerge, and although police could find no evidence against him, they would spend years publicly pursuing him, ultimately ruining his life. Decades after Martha's death, However, the case reopened, and there continues to be questions about what really happened. Before the decades of trials, appeals, and potential wrongful convictions, there was an innocent get-together for the teenagers in Greenwich, Connecticut. On October 30th, 1975, this is right before Halloween, Martha Moxley joined other friends and teens across the city for what they called the annual Mischief Night. I feel like we had that in Jellicoe, but we didn't call it Mischief Night. We just called it Halloween.
You just called it Thursday.
Yeah. But they got together for Mischief Night. This was a tradition for them. So this was something that was normal for a lot of kids, but this was for a few hours. They would get together, they would hang out, they would engage in mostly innocent, harmless pranks like toilet papering houses, playing ding-dong ditch at neighbors' houses, and making prank phone calls. So this was not like a crazy night. I mean, this was, Angelica, this was, like you said, a Thursday night.
Well, Greenwich, Connecticut is a very wealthy area. I mean, obviously, if close relatives of the Kennedys live there, a lot of affluent families live in that area, and these kids aren't going to go and do real damage to these super expensive homes. So it's really just a night for them to kind of let loose a little bit and not do any harm in the process.
Yeah, it certainly did not turn out to be like a fun, jolly night. I mean, this was the night that something tragic happened to Martha. So through the night there in 1975, on this day before Halloween, Martha spent much of her time hanging out with another teenager named Thomas Skagel. Now, this was the Skagel who was the relative of the Kennedy, like directly descended from Robert Kennedy, if I'm not mistaken there. Right, Jamie?
Their aunt was married to Robert Kennedy.
Ethel, I think is her name?
Yeah.
All right. I know my U.S. politics.
There you go. Trebek.
The Skagel family lived across the street from Martha's house, and the families were very friendly with each other. Like the Moxley family, Martha's family was also incredibly wealthy. They had a sprawling mansion. They even had live-in servants. I call them children at my house. I don't know. But no, they had people living in their house, taking orders and doing everything they needed them to do.
Yeah.
That's a very different lifestyle than what I'm used to. This, like we've said, the Skagels were closely related to Robert Kennedy. That's John F. Kennedy's brother, for some of you non-Americans who may not know that. And this was through marriage, like we've already said. According to friends and other witnesses at the party, Martha and Thomas flirted together all night. They eventually would kiss. Thomas's brother, Michael, apparently saw this flirtatious behavior and may have even been a little jealous of his brother's building relationship with this pretty and popular young lady named Martha. At about 10 p.m., Martha was last seen by the other partygoers going into the bushes with Thomas in the Skagels' backyard.
At this time, Thomas was 17, Michael was 15, and they lived very close together, these two families did. So that's going to play a key role as we talk about evidence that comes up later and proximity to alibis and those kinds of things. So the next day was Halloween, and it became clear that Martha had not come home the night before. Her family and her neighbors got really worried. They started calling all of her friends. Of course, I think as a parent, you're panicking, but you're just also kind of assuming, well, she slept over at a different friend's house. This was 1975. It's not like she could ping her cell phone to see where she was at the time. So they started calling around. They started searching. And it got desperate. And they realized that something bad must have happened to Martha. They ended up finding her body in her family's backyard, apparently placed underneath a tree that was kind of on the outskirts of the property that wouldn't be somewhere that you would just walk by walking toward the house. It was immediately clear that she had been beaten severely and that she was no longer alive. Her pants and underwear had been pulled down around her ankles, but there was no evidence that was reported of sexual assault at the time. They also found a broken golf club near her body, which will be a key piece of evidence we talk about later. Police were called, and they did a quick preliminary investigation. They talked to neighbors. They collected evidence from the area around where they found the body. They started trying to figure out where Martha had been the night before, who she had been with, and figure out who all they should talk to. When the autopsy was conducted, it revealed that, again, she had not been raped, despite the fact that her pants and underwear were down around her ankles. The cause of death was blunt force trauma. She was apparently beaten with this golf club so severely that it had broken. And when the head of the golf club broke off, the assailant used the sharp edges to stab Martha. This was a very brutal scene, very aggressive attack here. This wasn't just a, I'm going to hit her over the head to get her out of the way. This was aggressive is the only other word I keep coming back to, but horrible.
I found in my research, I found that when the club broke, he actually, like you said, stabbed her with it. And that's how she was found, was with part of this six iron, like sticking out of her neck because it was used to stab her so severely.
Police were really quickly able to track the origin of this golf club back to the Skakel family. They continued their interviews of everyone around. Again, they rounded up the teenagers, everybody who was at the party, anybody who had seen Martha at the Mischief Night party the night before. The witnesses told police that she had been with Thomas Skakel and that they had kind of gone off on their own during the party, and Thomas was very quickly the prime suspect. Immediately, the Skakel family shut down, they grew quiet, they lawyered up, and didn't talk to police at all. Thomas apparently it had some records of mental health and some, I don't know, issues of acting out in his past, so it wasn't going to look good for him to be a suspect because they could tell he was already troubled in a lot of ways. His alibi, when he was first questioned, was that he was driving with some of his cousins at the time of the murder, and he was briefly detained by the police. He was questioned and ultimately released.
Jamie, after the break, we will talk about the other suspects that emerged during the investigation and how police ultimately zeroed in on one person of interest.
Hey guys, Jamie and John here, and we want to tell you how excited we are to be able to offer new merchandise for our podcasts.
Yeah, we have partnered with a company called TeePublic. We have listed the links to our store below in our show notes. We've also put those on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But Jamie, there's a ton of stuff you can find over there.
T-shirts, phone cases, mugs, travel mugs, hoodies, and even masks, John.
There is a ton of new products over there. It's way better than the store we used to have. You can customize your order, like if you want a shirt that's yellow or green or blue, whatever, you can make that happen. So go over there and check that out today, and you will not be disappointed. Although Thomas was the primary suspect, police also began to look into a man named Kenneth Littleton. Now, he was a tutor who came into the home in an attempt to tutor Thomas and his brother Michael. Kenneth had been hired the very day of the murders in order to serve as a tutor to the six Skakel children. Not a great first day at work, right?
It's not. And like you mentioned, they had live-in servants. This was a live-in tutor, which I didn't even know was a thing.
I need a live-in tutor. I cannot afford one.
Especially with this virtual school situation, but that's
Let's not talk about that. So the night of the murders was his first night living in the mansion with the Skakel family. About a year after the murders, so we're talking about the summer of 1976, police brought Littleton in for questioning, and they had now started to believe that he may have been involved in the killing. He had quickly been fired as the Skakel family tutor because the Skakels were making poor grades. So it's pretty easy to fire somebody if your kids are making bad grades and they're the ones responsible for tutoring them. After being fired, it's said that he began to drink heavily. He eventually started to abuse drugs, and his life just kind of took a downward spiral. While intoxicated one day, he broke into a shop. He stole some merchandise. He actually stole a boat, and before he left the scene there, he vandalized property. So police, like I said, a year after this murder, they recognized that Littleton had been in the house, the same house that Martha was in on the night of her murder, and that, paired with this new criminal record, led police to consider him as a suspect. I'm going to say that I don't necessarily care for that. I understand it. I don't care for it. This was the first murder in this town in 30 years. So they are not accustomed to dealing with murders here.
They're not. And he had just moved in that day. And if you're a rich, powerful, influential family and the finger's being pointed at you and you have this newcomer to the town, that's an easy redirect for them to kind of get the attention off of them. So I imagine as soon as they fired him and police continued to question them about the murder, that it was easy for them to point the finger in his direction.
If you would have told me that they found his fingerprints on the part of the golf club, sure, I think bring him in for questioning. But I think he's just the guy that is being thrown under the bus. His life was ruined when he was the suspect, so he started abusing drugs and all that. So I don't know. Maybe he did have something to do with it. I feel like this is just kind of shoddy work right now.
Yeah, and it just got even worse for him, right?
So his name was now in the media as a suspect in this cold case. He eventually would lose his new teaching job. So he had tried to get his life on the straight and narrow, got a teaching job. It's gone. The accusations and public scrutiny eventually upset him so severely that he became suicidal. Eventually, police would stop considering Littleton as a suspect, but the damage was largely already done to his reputation. In 1991, so that's 20 years after this homicide, media began to print investigative stories about police conduct and why the case was never solved. Part of those reports was potential misconduct in harassing Littleton too much when there was no evidence that he was responsible. So at least I'm not on an island. At least there's somebody else who thought the same way I did there. As a result of the new stories, the public once again grew just very, very interested about this case, and really they were upset about the fact that it had never been solved. As a result, police reopened the investigation, and then again, they targeted Kenneth Littleton.
So they publicly say, or at least there are reports that, hey, they were going after this guy, there was no evidence, and that's why they didn't solve this. So in response, instead of accepting the mistake and moving forward, police just doubled down on it. They actually had Littleton's ex-wife meet him at a hotel wearing a wire. Her job was to get him to confess to this murder, but he never did. As police continued to look at him once again, he approached them. He told them that he was not responsible. He was more than happy to help in the investigation, and he wanted to find the killer of Martha Moxley as much as anybody did, because he wanted this to stop following him. Police invited him to another round of questioning, and he agreed. He brought his attorney. However, police believed that that was an indication of guilt, because he lawyered up. Now, we talk about this all the time. That's the right thing to do if you're being questioned by police as a suspect in a major criminal situation. You call your lawyer.
I'm listening to another podcast, one of my favorites. I won't say the name of it right now, but it's been like an investigative series. It's been like an 8-part. And they've brought in these potential suspects. They read them their rights. They ask them if they want an attorney, and they've said no. And then they incriminate themselves so badly. Look, they're guilty. I'm glad that they're going to spend the rest of their lives in jail, but for goodness sakes, people, get an attorney, like, early. Don't answer any questions until you get an attorney.
Yeah, so they saw him with an attorney and thought, well, that must mean he's guilty. So they interrogate him for 4 days straight. They got him to take 2 different lie detector tests. In 1998, again, this is 23 years after the murder, they had a grand jury meet to look at the evidence in the case and determine once and for all if Littleton would be charged for the crime. The decision was resounding. No charges would be filed because there was no evidence to connect Littleton with the actual murder. He had essentially been a police scapegoat for 23 years. He had been their focus. And anytime police get tunnel vision like that, it makes it so hard for them to actually step back and see where the evidence actually leads. As part of the grand jury investigation, taped interviews with Littleton were played for the court. In it, he told police, again, a lot of these recordings were from many years before, that he had actually suspected Michael Skakel, the brother of Thomas. Michael, who was Martha's age, had apparently been jealous of his brother on the night of her death, and he had a big crush, maybe an infatuation with Martha. In the tapes, Littleton told police that Michael had a troubled youth. He was 15 years old at the time of the murder, but he was already an alcoholic. In the brief time that Littleton tutored Michael Skakel, he had found small animals killed and nailed to the ground around the Skakel property. Michael also had a host of disciplinary issues, which was part of the reason that Littleton was hired to come in and be his teacher to help him to focus on his studies and not get distracted by all these other activities that kept getting him in trouble. Police already knew that Michael was the last person to report seeing Martha alive, but after a brief interview just after the murder, he had largely escaped police's attention, with only a couple of other brief interviews with police. This may have been because of the influence of his family. Again, they shut down. They lawyered up and wouldn't talk to police, and maybe the police were afraid to continue to push on that. They were related to the Kennedys. Police didn't want to publicly go after this family, and it proved to be wrong, and then be left with egg on their face. Littleton has since detailed the two decades where he was considered the main suspect in the case and said that he lived in perpetual fear. He felt like the wealthy families that were pointing the finger at him had worked to frame him for these murders and may even arrange for him to be killed so that the case would completely go away. But now police were kind of back to looking at Thomas and especially Michael Skakel as potential suspects in this crime. And as they began to dig, they found a lot of different things that implicated issues between Martha and these boys. Here's some journal entries that Martha had just the month leading up to her being killed. This was in September of 1975. She wrote, "Dear Diary, me, Jackie, Michael, Tom, Hope, Maureen, and Andrew went out driving in Tom's car. I was practically sitting on Tom's lap because I was only steering. He kept putting his hand on my knee. Then I was driving again, and Tom put his arm around me. He kept doing stuff like that." She also had an entry about Michael in September of that year. She said, "Michael was so totally out of it, and he was being a real asshole in his words and actions. He kept telling me that I was leading Tom on when I don't like him, except as a friend. I said, well, how about you and Jackie? You keep telling me you don't like her and you've been all over her. He doesn't understand that he can be nice to her without hanging all over her." So she's starting to notice that he's a little aggressive when he is attracted to someone. And in another journal entry, just a smaller note, said that she believed that as it pertained to the Skakel home, that maybe she needed to, quote unquote, stop going over there.
What about that entry from September 12th, the one where she said she was practically sitting in his lap? She kind of ended that by saying that he was putting his hand on her knee, putting his arm around her, and that he kept doing stuff like that. I mean, it definitely seems like from the September 19th entry that Michael is definitely more aggressive, but it seems like Tom doesn't really know when to keep his hands to himself either. I don't know that that implicates him on murder, but it seems like both of these boys had some boundary issues, and I think that's safe to say. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think that's very important to note when looking at this. And I think once these journal entries came forward in combination with what Littleton said about the boys, that helped police to really focus on the Skakel family as part of the investigation.
So over the years, Michael Skakel had changed his alibi for the night of the murder several times, as did his brother Thomas. One of Michael's alibis that was that he was with his cousins, but at another point he confessed that he was actually there and was peeping through a stranger's window at the time of the killings. I've actually found in some of my research that he confessed to staring through Martha's window and was masturbating in a tree when he was doing so. Did you see that when
I found that as well. And I mean, if you're not looking to be implicated for murder, maybe don't say that you're doing a very invasive, inappropriate act with the murder victim as the focus of your act. So that's certainly damning in my eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. So students at the Ellen School, a school for troubled youth that the boys had attended, reported that Michael confessed to them that he had killed Martha with the golf club, and that he actually said to them at school, "I'm going to get away with murder. I'm a Kennedy." Part of me wonders, is this a boy trying to be tough and they know that he's associated with this, so he's trying to be tough? or is he saying that because he did it? You know, I mean, I don't think you should say stuff like that if you didn't do it. So it's pretty damning in my mind.
It is. And there are also questions that are going to come up about whether he actually said it or not. But if he did indeed say it, then he's troubled in one way or another for sure.
So in 1991, that's when this case kind of reopened from the media's perspective and put some pressure on the police, and then it was reopened, right? So at that time, the Skagel family hired a firm of private investigators to determine what actually happened on that night there in 1975. That report came back and indicated that Thomas and Michael should be looked into as being responsible, due in large part to their inability to maintain a firm, consistent alibi.
So let's be clear. The Skakel family hired these private investigators to find out what happened to clear their names, and the report they got back implicated their family. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I just want, like, a lot of times when you hear about a family hiring a private investigator, you think of some, like, wannabe cop who didn't have what it takes to be a real cop. If I'm not mistaken, and I don't have it right in front of me, one of them was a retired FBI agent, and the other one was a retired cop. So these were like people who investigated stuff regularly.
Yeah, so it was a legitimate investigation.
And I don't think that, you know, most families would do this and they would be like, all right, I need you to put the heat on somebody else here. These guys came back and said, actually, we need to be looking at your children. So I think kudos to those guys who did this They didn't care to say what was right.
They were objective, which is more than we can say for a lot of other people involved in this case.
Numerous books have been published which also identified Michael as the likely killer, and two of the lead detectives in Greenwich felt that Michael was responsible for this. In 2000, a grand jury that had been investigating this case for 2 years finally indicted Michael Skagel for the murder. He surrendered to police the same day and was released on a $500,000 bail. In those early days, there was some discussion as to whether Skagel would be tried as a child or as an adult. So he was 15 years old at the time of the murder. And I just want to stop there and just ask, what would you do if you were the judge who had to make this decision? Would you try him as a child because he was 15 or as an adult because he's an adult now?
Yeah, that's tough because he's 40.
Yeah.
So if you try him as a child, what are they going to do, put a 40-year-old in juvie?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the reason they were determining which way to do this, because if they tried him as a child, then more than likely he would have just got like 3 years until he turned 18, and then he would be released and his records would be sealed. Ultimately, they decided to try him as an adult, and that was, I think that's a pretty bold move there. I think it's the right move. I just think that a lot of folks were expecting it to go differently.
Yeah, absolutely.
In May 2002, nearly 30 years after Martha Moxley was brutally murdered, Michael Skagel's trial began. Now, Skagel's shaky alibis were really a central piece of the evidence that was brought up in this trial. Paired with other evidence, such as him boasting that he had committed the murders and he would get away with it. You know, we talked about that. He said that at his school. You know, you mentioned the fact that there was animals killed on the property, and Michael was directly attributed to that. He had a lot of previous disciplinary actions. He had some substance abuse issues. He had some psychiatric issues. So they were really able to build a pretty strong case against him. I guess I'm going to stop there and just process this for a minute. I see all this, but none of that is like hardcore physical evidence that directly ties him to this crime scene. I think you're building a lot of circumstantial evidence, but not like, you don't have his fingerprints on a golf club. You don't have any witnesses seeing him stab her or beat her to death. You know, I wish that it was a stronger case so that at the end of the day, I knew who was responsible if he's found guilty.
Don't get me wrong. I think there are situations when circumstantial evidence can be enough, when it can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm not sure we have quite that much circumstantial evidence here, so I'm with you. I'm not sure this was really enough to convict, especially with a family this powerful. I mean, like it or not, these people usually get away with things unless there is that hardcore evidence you're talking about, and it wasn't there. But what happened?
Well, in June 2002, Michael was found guilty of the murder and sentenced to 20 years in prison.
Wow. So 20 years. He's 40. So he's going to be in prison until he was 60. If he had been tried when he was a teenager as a minor, he probably would have been free by the time he was 25 or 30, right?
Yeah.
So the delay in the investigation obviously had an impact on this. To say that was just or not, I think we'll get some of that a little later. He immediately appealed the verdict, as he should have, as everybody does when they're found guilty of a crime. He complained that the prosecution edited taped interviews with him to make it sound like he was saying things that he wasn't, to make it sound like he was actually confessing when he wasn't saying that. In the unedited version, he never confessed to the killing and was, in reality, explaining his alibi, which was, like you mentioned, peeping into the windows at the Moxley home. His appeal went all the way to the Connecticut Supreme Court, which affirmed his conviction. He appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, but they refused to hear the case. In 2007, after several years behind bars, his attorneys requested a new trial based on this new evidence. In 2003, there was a private investigator hired by the Skakel family that had gone to Los Angeles and interviewed a man named Tony Bryant, who is the cousin of Kobe Bryant. In the interview, Bryant claimed that he had intended to sexually assault Moxley back in 1975, and he was kind of, for lack of a better word, creeping around that evening. But he had never come forward because he didn't want to be considered a suspect for the murder. But he still insisted he was not involved in any wrongdoing to Moxley that night, but that he did have poor intentions. I'm not sure how that's any kind of evidence or grounds for appeal there, but that was part of what they submitted. They also said that they found evidence that his classmates who allegedly heard him confess never actually knew him. That these people who said, yeah, he said he killed over the golf clubs and he's going to get away with it because he's a Kennedy, were never around him. So the speculation there is that they wanted attention, so they came forward to implicate Michael in the murder. And finally, his attorneys argued that the former lead defense attorney was incompetent, and he enjoyed being in the spotlight of this high-profile case so much that he hadn't prepared a full defense for Skakel during his trial. That appeal was denied until 2013, when a judge finally found that Skakel's defense was incompetent for not bringing in a potential alibi and granted him a new trial. That trial was set to begin, and this is 11 years he had been in prison for this crime. He was released in 2013 on $1.2 million bail as he awaited a second trial. While he was waiting, the state Supreme Court overturned the decision to overturn the conviction, arguing that his defense was competent and that there was overwhelming evidence against him, which I'm not sure how somebody could read this case file and use that terminology, but the state Supreme Court did. He was returned to prison to continue serving his sentence. And then in 2018 is when his legal story goes back his way. In 2016, a couple of years before that, Robert Kennedy Jr. had published a book, and it was titled Framed: Why Michael Skakel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit. Now, I'm not saying this book itself is what caused this decision to be made, but fast forward to 2018, and the state Supreme Court overruled their previous decision and found that the original trial was unfair because Skakel had inefficient representation from his defense attorney. A new trial was ordered, and he was set to be released from prison again. So now he's awaiting his second trial as of 2018. But then you fast forward to just a few months ago, in October of 2020, the state of Connecticut made a big announcement about this case. And that's kind of why it's been in the news as of late. That announcement is that they would not retry Michael Skakel for the murder of Martha Moxley. They said they did not have enough evidence to give them a chance to win another conviction.
So really, over the course of a few decades, there was no justice for Martha Moxley. If you kind of look at Skakel's case, I mean, I don't know how you can say that's justice if he was convicted and then it was overturned and they're not going to try him again. I mean, that's pretty much like saying we got it wrong and we're sorry, you know. So two men had their lives ruined if they didn't have anything to do with this. We're talking about Littleton there and Michael Skagel. And this case generated media attention since the 1970s. There was a book written in 1999 by Mark Furman. Yes, that is the one associated with the O.J. Simpson case. You've probably heard that name before. And at the time of this recording, there are no other known persons of interest in the Martha Moxley case.
So we've had two primary suspects. Well, I guess three. The very first suspect was Thomas Skagel, but that was very short-lived as the family really kind of gathered the troops and circled the wagons and didn't let the investigation get the information that they need. And then for 20 years, they really ruined the life of the live-in tutor, Littleton, and now Michael Skagel spent 13 years behind bars for this murder, starting when he was 40 years old. And at this point, he was 60 when he was finally cleared of this conviction. So it seems like this was an incredible crime that police just couldn't crack, or law enforcement really butchered this from the beginning, potentially ruining lives of two innocent men, or perhaps even letting the killer go on more than one occasion because they had tunnel vision in one direction or another.
Yeah, I think the most tragic part of this case, other than her death, was the fact that there's no justice for her death. It's absolutely sickening to think that, you know, I feel like most police departments would have walked away with a lot more evidence in this case. There would be somebody behind bars for this murder right now, and justice could have been served. That doesn't bring back Martha, but that does certainly go a long way in just kind of letting the family know that people cared enough to look into it. They found what happened and justice was served. We don't have that here. So,
yeah,
I don't know, man.
Martha's mom was interviewed after the decision was made not to retry Skagel for this murder, and honestly, she sounded okay with not going through another trial. She felt like police had their man. He's not going to spend the rest of his life in jail, but he had been identified. And to her, that was enough that it made it not worth sitting through another trial and reliving all those details.
Yeah, that's going to do it for this one, I think. I mean, do you want to go as far as to speculate who you think did it, or do you just want to...
I feel like there's
away.
Just so little evidence to try to determine that. I don't think it was Littleton. I don't think they ever had anything on him. I feel like the case against Skagel was mostly circumstantial. His alibi issues are a problem for me, but that's not enough to convict somebody beyond a reasonable doubt for murder. I don't know. It's tough, and I have a hard time saying, yeah, I really strongly believe that it's one person or another. I'm just afraid that police did such a poor job in the beginning that this is one we'll never solve.
Yeah. And that breaks my heart for Martha and for her family, but I kind of think you're right. I don't know that we're ever really going to get to the bottom of this one. And it's sad, man.
It is. Thanks for hanging out with us during this case. We hope you enjoyed hearing our discussion on it. Again, this had a lot of twists and turns. That's something that always keeps my attention, so I was excited to share it with our listeners as well. Don't forget to go back and check out True Crime To Go, which will be dropping on your feed every now and then until we find a more formal plan.
Be patient with us as we kind of figure this out, but the best way to make sure that you don't miss it is to go ahead and hit subscribe so that anytime we release a new episode, you're going to have it downloaded automatically on your phone. You can set that sucker up to notify you too. This is a high-tech world we live in, folks, so let it help you out there so you don't never miss a episode of True Crime Cast or True Crime To Go.
There you go. We'll be back next week with another interesting case, and we appreciate you supporting True Crime Cast.
Like we mentioned at the first of the episode, don't forget to check out Patreon. There's a lot of good stuff over there. You don't want to miss that. That's all for now, but until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.